This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff. RAF gives the world's top wrestlers the stage they earned but never had until now.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We have made it to Friday. This is your humble DC correspondent back again, trying to fill the giant shoes of Brian Kilmeade on the best radio show, the most powerful radio show from coast to coast, the Brian Kilmeade Show. I am Griff, and I just, you know, we made it to Friday, but that rings different for me because I have, for the last 3 days, been getting the full Kilmeade experience. It is 3 hours of television, getting up at 2:33 in the morning, then coming and doing 3 hours of radio. Yesterday, I actually, right after I got off the radio show, went down and did another hour on Outnumbered. Today, I'll go all the way through the end of Will Cain's show. And that's barely scratching the surface for what Brian Kilmeade does. Brian Kilmeade is an energizer bunny. You know, it's said about so many people that, oh, so-and-so, he's the hardest working man in show business. Let me tell you something. Brian Kilmeade is hands down the hardest working man in show business. There is no comparison. No one even comes close. He stands high above anybody else. And I wanted to talk a little bit just real quick because we have so much going on in the world, a possible Putin-Trump meeting. We've got obviously a ground incursion going into Gaza. We've got South Carolina Congresswoman Nancy Mesa coming on today. Is she, of course, announcing for governor and a whole lot more. But I do just want to take a minute because for any of the listeners that haven't heard me talk about it in previous days, I started in talk radio. Talk radio is home. It is such a huge honor and privilege to sit behind a microphone for a guy that started the Oliver North radio show in the mid 90s, Common Sense Radio with Ollie North. Then here at Fox News Radio, I was here on day one when they founded it, and I got to produce the Tony Snow Show, the great late Tony Snow, who of course was a Fox host, Fox News Sunday, the weekend hosting, and the Tony Snow radio show before he went on to be President George W. Bush's press secretary and one of the best in history, if I'm being honest about it. The D.C. radio studio for Fox News Radio is named after Tony Snow. But so that's just a setup that, you know, I'm a radio guy. I like the feel of these words. I could be no otherwise than I could change the color of my eyes. But let me just tell you that during the time that Tony Snow went to the White House, and this is a story I wanted to tell you quickly. Tony Snow, of course, left, and we had this Tony Snow show. We had to fill in. Well, the guy that raised his hand for the network that wanted to sit in, that did the best job and just crushed it, was a guy named Brian Kilmeade. So from Washington, D.C., remotely, I would have Brian Kilmeade filling in, and he was the absolute kindest, most professional gentleman ever. And, you know, he obviously, the Tony Snow Show now became the Brian Kilmeade Show, and he has taken it to heights never thought before. And Fox News Radio has never been stronger or bigger because, in large part, to Brian Kilmeade. But this is the hardest working man in show business that has never hesitated once to reach out and encourage me along my way. And now I get to sit behind this microphone for him. It is such a treat, and it's very special to be with you guys. So enough about me. I know I went on for a rant. I got to speak, by the way, as we talk about this Trump-Putin potential meeting. Nobody better to talk to than four-star retired General Jack Keane. I talked to him earlier. Here's a little bit of our conversation.
We're getting brand new details on a possible Trump Putin's summit. Well, our sources saying they're aiming for the end of next week for a meeting in eyeing Hungary, Switzerland, the UAE as possible locations, and Russia is facing a deadline today to agree to a peace deal with Ukraine or face new sanctions. Here to react is retired four-star general and Fox News senior strategist General Jack Keane. General, thank you for joining us. You may have heard this breaking news we got from the White House with Jackie. It looks like they have a tentative possible meeting for next week, and the locations are, of course, Rome, but now you've got Hungary, Switzerland, potentially the UAE. What do you make of all of this?
Well, obviously, at the meeting that Witkoff had with Putin, he obviously was willing to make some kind of concession. I think a meeting with the president couldn't have been just a physical meeting reinforcing the discussions that they've had in the past by phone, which lasted in some cases for hours, and no progress being made. I don't think the president would stand for that, to travel and come out with the same result. So I think it's pretty obvious that some concession has been made. And what I think the Trump national security team is doing in negotiations with the Russians is trying to really work the details of what that concessions are. What's the framework? What are the conditions surrounding that? And make certain they really understand everything. You know, Putin is a master at deception. He's a master at saying one thing and doing another. And we've seen that for several months here during these negotiations. So I think that that's kind of where we are. There likely could be a significant concession, certainly what the president wants, as he said all along. He wants a ceasefire and the beginning of negotiations for war termination. Whether that's actually going to take place remains to be seen. It could be a partial ceasefire. We've seen that before, Griff. Example of something that Putin could put on the table would be no more airstrikes on civilian populations, and no more airstrikes, moratorium completely, withdraw some troops from some portion of Ukraine that he's physically occupying, and make a concession that he'll take control of these other portions of Ukraine. So there's plenty of options in terms of what potential concessions. Certainly the one that Trump wants is ceasefire, begin the negotiation, the end of the war.
Yeah,
remains to be seen whether that's really on the table or not.
In general, the president has obviously expressed his frustrations with Putin, and he says he wants the killing to stop. But something, to your point, is clearly giving the White House some confidence that Putin may be ready for a peace deal after we are learning that the talks may have hit a bit of a snag after Zelensky says that he has to depend on even Parliament to make any land concessions.
Well, yeah, there's some political posturing being done there, I think, by President Zelensky. This deal initially is going to be made between President Trump and President Putin. That we've known from the outset. Zelensky's already on the table for a ceasefire leading to war termination discussions. He has removed any conditions for doing all of that. And where Zelensky will put his foot down, and the United States likely as well, is one, regime change in Ukraine, which Putin wants. Two, he wants all four oblasts, even though he doesn't currently occupy all of those four oblasts. And he wants the Ukraine military to demilitarize.
Yeah.
Those are things that just are unacceptable. And we know those are the conditions that have been on the table for some time from Mr. Putin. What I'm encouraged about this, Griff, is Putin seems to be somewhat intimidated by the prospect of sanctions. You know, oil is down, oil revenue, which is what he depends on, is down 17%. That's not due to sanctions. It's due to the reduction of the oil price, worldwide oil price. And so he's looking at this thing, and he knows full well if that revenue begins to dry up for him, and he's a one-commodity economy, oil and gas, then he has problems sustaining his defense industrial base. He knows that. He's going to have challenges even without sanctions in 26 sustaining that defense industrial base, given the path he's on with his economy right now. So any further squeeze on him will have its impact. Plus, we're upgunning Ukraine. So there are things happening here positively in terms of Ukraine and the president and its impact on Putin's decision-making.
Well, General, you're so spot on. And, you know, we'll also be watching what plays out in Israel, in Gaza. And we wanted to talk about that. But we appreciate having you here with these new details with this Putin-Trump possible summit. Very, very interesting stuff. And we appreciate your insight. It's spot on, as always. General Jack Keane, have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too, guys. You and the team. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. So we'll see where this goes. It's obviously fluid and moving. That was General Jack Keane you just heard from. Coming up next, we have the South Carolina Congresswoman, now gubernatorial candidate, Nancy Mace, jumping in with a splash, slinging sharp elbows. We're going to ask her all about the race and what she wants to do for the Palmetto State when we come back.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Like no other, indeed. It is Friday, and I am having too much fun. A human should be allowed to. Griff Jenkins, your humble correspondent from D.C., filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the Great Brian Kilmeade Show. And we are very lucky to bring in our special guest now, Congresswoman Nancy Mace. She is a congresswoman you know well and have seen and liked on Fox News, talking about all sorts of things. She now this week dropping in to South Carolina's governor's race and making quite a splash. Congresswoman, thank you for joining us.
And good morning, America. It's so great to have this announcement, big announcement this week. It's been amazing and deeply humbling, the outpouring of support.
It is a big announcement, Congresswoman. And in full disclosure, I've had such a privilege and honor to interview you so many times on important issues in Washington. But you made the decision. You decided that your skills and talents were better spent in the Palmetto State and home in the governor's mansion. Tell me why and how you came about this decision.
Well, we have a huge opportunity in the midterms next year to elect America First governors who can implement President Trump's agenda at the state level on down. And that's what we're going to do. I've learned so much in my 4.5 years in Congress. And the other thing is, too, is that, you know, when I came into Congress, I said I believe in term limits. I said I would only do 3 terms. And so I'm self-term limiting myself. Like, if you believe in something, then you should probably operate that way. Put your money where your mouth is. And it's time for South Carolina to elect a new leader in the congressional district next year in the midterms. And I've taken this seat from being a Democrat seat to being a stronghold Republican seat. And we will win it again in the congressional seat next year. But I'm excited. I got a lot of plans for South Carolina.
Well, you know, Congresswoman, you mentioned something there that I haven't heard in a long time, and that is term limits. I can remember being in Washington when that was actually something that the Conservative Party, conservatives and the Republican Party really wanted. Now it seems to be something of a relic, but you're making that choice. That's great. Now, let's talk about, you jumped into an already pretty crowded field, and no surprise, as a tough congresswoman, went to the Citadel, came in with some pretty sharp elbows. First, before we talk about your sort of exchange and really going pretty quickly at each other with the Attorney General, Alan Wilson, let's talk about just how crowded that field is in South Carolina. Was that something that you looked at and said, no, I'm still going in?
Well, we're leading in all of the third-party independent polling. We're ahead of every other candidate. There are 5 of us. 3 of them are in low single digits. It's really a 2-person race between me and the Attorney General. And we're just going to crush it. We're going to crush him. We're going to crush his record. I have the best record of anyone that is running for governor in terms of supporting the president. I was there to help him get Mike Johnson elected, the Speaker of the House that he wanted. I helped fire the director of the Secret Service after Donald Trump was shot. I was there defending Donald Trump as a rape survivor during the infamous George Stephanopoulos interview that Donald Trump won a $15 million defamation suit against. So there's no one else in the race that I would argue has President Trump's back as much as I do. And my record speaks for itself, and I'm running against an attorney general who lets off pedophiles for one day in jail. There's case after case I've been highlighting. What I believe to be very disturbing and alarming, and I'm running on law and order because we had a sanctuary sheriff over the last 4 years in South Carolina, and our attorney general did nothing while she let out illegals who are rapists, murderers, and pedophiles. Like, if that's the future of South Carolina, that's not what the people want. They want someone who respects the president, respects federal and state law, and will keep our community safe with law and order.
Well, and Congresswoman, to be fair to everyone, to all the candidates in this race, yourself and the attorney general, we had the attorney general on earlier this week, and he did sort of address this. I want to play you a little bit of what he said and have you respond. Listen here.
She's accused me of all kinds of things. I mean, she's accused me of putting, you know, not putting people away in prison for but a single day. The reality is that my office has quadrupled the size of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. We have expanded the Human Trafficking Task Force. We are supporting local law enforcement and moving backlogs. And she is just throwing every single piece of mud she can in our general direction. But the truth of the matter is, she's I guess she's nervous about the polls. She sees me as an impediment to her political ambition. And
okay, I would just get your response to that.
Well, I mean, he's really just sort of full of it. I mean, I'm working off of his record, not his rhetoric. And he can have as many task forces as he wants, but the facts are that human trafficking and sex trafficking is up over 400% in the last decade since he's been in office. There's no end in sight. It's increased. He allowed a sanctuary sheriff go rogue in South Carolina. He prosecutes convicted pedophiles and lets them off for one day in jail. There's a case in South Carolina where a guy had 1,900 images of kids as young as three being assaulted by animals, and he was facing 60 years. And the attorney general in South Carolina, Alan Wilson, prosecuted that case, gave him a plea deal in 15 minutes. He was facing 60 years. Alan Wilson said he put it down and let him serve one day in jail. And there are other convicted pedophile cases just like that. And I'm a victim of the system. I work with victims. I have so many victims that are coming forward asking for my help because they're not getting it from the attorney general. So I'm going to fight hard. I'm going to fight on the facts. I'm going to fight on the truth. And I will not allow him or anyone else in this race smear my record, lie about my record. And I'm going to fight hard, just like President Trump, when they're coming after me, and the establishment, because he's part of it, is coming after me, because I'm standing up for you. I'm standing up for South Carolinians. I'm standing up for every hardworking American who's been ignored by the system. Mm-hmm. I'm here to fight for you.
And, you know, the Attorney General seems to be saying in his defense that these are judges that make those decisions. But it's fascinating when you say, Congresswoman, you know, you're going to fight tough, and as tough as anybody else in that race. I ask you sort of the same question I asked the Attorney General, which was, you know, already it's gotten pretty pretty nasty already, the fighting, and obviously maybe a preview of what's to come. Are you concerned at all that the race gets too negative, that it's bad for South Carolina?
Well, it's not great, especially when you have the chief law enforcement officer, the attorney general, attacking someone who was gone to law enforcement, worked with law enforcement, provided evidence to law enforcement. I'm actually a key witness in an investigation right now where I provided information to law enforcement, and he's tampering with that. He's trying to taint a jury pool for a future civil and or criminal case in the courts of South Carolina. And what Donald Trump is all about, Donald Trump is about the truth. Donald Trump is against weaponizing the justice system. And I'm going to be just like Trump in high heels when I see the weaponization general's office or a solicitor's office. Like in one of our counties in South Carolina, we have over 350 murder cases that are not being prosecuted in just one of our counties in South Carolina. So I'm here to bring the truth. I'm here to bring law and order, and I'm here to bring justice for everyone who deserves it.
Donald Trump in high heels. Congresswoman Nancy Mace, we've got to leave it there. We're going up against a hard break. Thank you for taking time and speaking on behalf of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We hope you will continue to come back and talk about this race. It's one of the most interesting in the country. Congresswoman, have a great weekend.
Anytime. Thank you. God bless.
All right. That was Congresswoman Nancy Grace, now candidate for governor of the Palmetto State. We've got a whole lot more coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hello and happy Friday. Griff Jenkins filling in here for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Having so much fun with Eric, Pete, and Allison. Brian's got some deserved time off, but I am excited to be sitting here. And I'm really excited to talk to our next guest, Bobby Barak, because, Bobby, you understand so well things of culture and the landscape of late night TV. And I tell you, I just thought so much. I thought the appearance last night of our pal Greg Gutfeld on Fallon was dynamite. It was an 11 out of 10, the way Gutfeld handled it, the way Gutfeld went in there and told the story about how he and Jimmy Fallon first met. It's awesome. I want you to listen to this, and then we'll talk about it.
This is hilarious. We've met before.
Yes. You have no memory of it, understandable because we were wasted.
Okay. You're not making this up. I totally know what you're talking about.
I pull out a cigarette. I light a cigarette and I'm smoking it. And you stop and you come over to me and you grab it and you crinkle it and you go, "These things will kill you." And you threw it. And then I go, dude, "I'm not rich." "You're rich. I have to put that." Cigarettes are expensive in New York City. And then 5 minutes later, you come back with a fresh pack of Parliaments and you hand them to me and you go, "Here." And I go, "That was really sweet. You want me to die?"
All right, Bobby, what do you think of this?
No, I thought that conversation was funny. And Griff, when I first saw the news that Gutfeld was going to appear on Fallon, my first thought was, does this happen if CBS doesn't cancel Colbert? This seems like Fallon and NBC realizing that, or Fallon more particularly, that this pivot to far left politics really damaged late night television. I think Fallon sees a writing on the wall and he realizes, hey, by bringing on Gutfeld and bringing on other voices, maybe it will save me, because Colbert, he did the opposite of that. I think the numbers say that he's had one conservative-leaning guest on the past 12 months. So I think this is a direct response to Colbert's show failing.
Yeah, it's a great point, Bobby. And, you know, to be fair to Jimmy Fallon, I think there is a perception that he was never quite as harsh as a guy like Colbert. I mean, Colbert, literally in the 2 weeks since the show's canceled, had 100% of liberal guests on, and Fallon was not there. And, you know, you hear Gutfeld and others talk about Fallon, and they say kind things. I was interviewing Jimmy Fallon just the other day, and Fallon said that literally when Fallon got his own show, Fallon sent him a note. I think sent him some cookies or something even. And you know, that speaks to kind of the character of a guy like Jimmy Fallon. But I think that you put your finger spot on that Fallon sees that because of the Colbert, what happened with Paramount, that he said, hey, we got to lean in to this. You know, we are isolating, or alienating, I should say, a large part of our audience with just this diatribe of just Orange Man bad all night long.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote a column 2 weeks ago on the transition of late night. And I mean, for those that don't remember, late night was not all that political before Donald Trump descended down the elevator in 2015. Of course, they mentioned politics in the news, but it wasn't overt. But once Trump moved into the political space, those shows became political every night, but it never really fit Fallon. Obviously, Colbert had the background from the Colbert Report. Jimmy Kimmel, for whatever reason, really leaned into it. I think he probably hates Donald Trump as much as anybody on television. Fallon has always bounced back and forth between trying to impress those Hollywood elites and still being the funny, goofy guy he was on Saturday Night Live. So I will say Fallon has never been nearly as obnoxious as the other two.
Exactly. And you're so right. I mean, I think there was a anticipation by some that, oh, Gutfeld's going to sit down with Jimmy Fallon. It's going to be a slugfest. It's going to get nasty. It's going to be about Trump. And you know what? It wasn't at all. It wasn't political. It was great comedy, great storytelling, and even touching at moments when, you know, they were talking about their first meeting and their friendship. And, you know, it really did. It was exactly as you say, Bobby, a reminder that the late night comedy landscape wasn't always this nasty and political. It was just funny. That's what you did at night. It was the end of the night. Maybe you were even tucked in bed. You wanted to take yourself to a happier place and get a couple of laughs. I think that Gutfeld's appearance was a great thing for late night comedy's landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And for a reminder, again, the reason that Jon Stewart was so innovative is because he did a late night political show. So that's just a reminder. The other shows did not lean into that stuff before Donald Trump, and it obviously damaged them severely. According to Puck News, Griff, they've lost 50% of their revenue in 7 years. I mean, that's astronomical. And Colbert is gone. He's not coming back. I think the future of Jimmy Kimmel is certainly up in the air, especially with his contract about to expire in 2026. So I don't know what the future of late night on the broadcast networks is, but it certainly isn't promising.
You say Colbert's gone, Bobby, but, you know, if Charlemagne the God gets his wish, he's going to get a political ticket in 2028 of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. I'm not sure that actually has any legs, but what the hell do I know? I'll tell you what I do know, Bobby, just to change gears a little bit, and it was the story of the week, man, and it's a great one, and that is I don't know how high Sydney Sweeney can go, but she is on a freaking roll. I mean, it is unbelievable. And you know, it just looks like that the way American Eagle and Sydney Sweeney have played this, that it's like the official will look back at this and say that was the day that the woke culture died.
It's a great point by you. And full disclosure, I actually purchased an American Eagle t-shirt this week just in support of Sydney Sweeney and a rejection of the woke left cancel culture.
Brilliant.
Here's what I love about this, Griff, is that had people not had a fit and started comparing the ad to Nazi Germany, most of us wouldn't even have known that she did this marketing tool. But the people trying to cancel her and shame American Eagle have made her so much more popular. I saw over the weekend BuzzFeed did this expose revealing that she registered as a Republican. That just made her more popular because Donald Trump shared it. We track internet interest on our site Outkick. In the moment BuzzFeed doxed her as a Republican, the interest in her spiked by 3 times.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw Clay Travis was talking about this, and he's so spot on, Clay. He said, you know, if Bud Light were smart, they'd rush out right now and hire Sydney Sweeney, put her in a hot T-shirt drinking a Bud Light, and gone would be any memory of Dylan Mulvaney and the horrific mistake, misguided campaign they tried to launch with that. I think, you know, and I love you went out and bought an American Eagle t-shirt. I think there is going to be maybe though a now sort of competition amongst other companies that are going to look at that and say, wow, maybe we should try and do something like that.
Absolutely. And I mean, here's my big takeaway. People on the left, particularly in the media and MSNBC, they spent the past month shaming people for liking Hulk Hogan and shaming people for liking hot women. That's where Americans draw the line, Griff. It's a bad thing to like pretty women and Hulk Hogan. The left is not going to win the culture war. It's just that simple.
No, and for a guy, look, I'm 54. Let me tell you, I remember being a youngster back in the day when Brooke Shields was doing exactly the same thing in Calvin Klein jeans. And, you know, her tagline was, "Nothing comes between me and my Calvin Klein jeans." And every guy my age said, "I wish I were between you and your jeans."
Exactly.
And I'll leave it at that. Hey, real quick, before I run out of time, because yeah. I love Bobby, you can talk about anything and everything. It's so good. And something that kind of caught my eye, and look, I live in D.C. I've lived in D.C. for 3.5 decades. And I think the entire time, maybe Glenn Kessler has been the fact checker at the Washington Post. And in full disclosure, I still read the Washington Post. Got to know what everybody's saying. But he did an interview with Mark Halperin, and they were talking about the bias. Does it even exist in the Washington Post newsroom? Here's a little bit of how that went. Cut 28.
How could it be that I see the Post as fundamentally anti-Trump in every day, in every crevice of every story, practically, and you say we are down the middle by the book, and the fact that our readers are liberal is because we're in Washington, D.C.? How could that be?
Well, okay. First of all, it's because you're wrong and I'm right, Mark. I was in the newsroom and I watched how the stories were put together and
yeah.
what's the editorial discussions were. So now that I am away from the newsroom and I'm going to read it as an ordinary reader, you know, based on the comments you've made to me, I will have an open mind to see what I see. But I do know when, you know, it's not like people in the newsroom are saying, we've got to get Donald Trump. We've got to write this story. We've got to slant it in a way that is negative to Donald Trump.
It's more, I agree with you. It's more insidious. It's more insidious than that. It'd be some ways it'd be more comforting to me if they said, we're not trying to be objective. We think Donald Trump's bad for the country. He's against abortion rights. He's corrupt. He's a liar. Look at all the four Pinocchios he gets. We need to protect Joe Biden and destroy him. That'd be better.
What do you make of this?
I'm so with him. I always say I have more respect for MSNBC than I do CNN because they admit that they have a vendetta against Donald Trump, right? I mean, I'm fine because Rachel Maddow, she obviously hates Trump, whatever. It bothers me the people like Jake Tapper and Anderson Cooper who pretend that they're journalists, and the same thing with the Washington Post. That is not a honest news publication anymore. Just look how they covered the Russia hoax or how they didn't cover the Hunter Biden laptop story. So I'm totally with Halperin. I'd much rather them just admit that they want to destroy Donald Trump than pretend that they're actual journalists just covering the news and landing on the truth.
Yeah, and it's Mark Halperin, really, it was a good interview with Kessler, and I'm not sure Kessler can be just a average Washington reader now, as he says, but it is a great point that, you know, if you can at least see blatantly what your bias is, then it's not like you're having to read between the lines and decipher anything. I wonder, you know, we have lived here at Fox News, and I've been here since the year 2000, and, you know, we've all heard fair, balanced, and as Brett Baer says, unafraid. I think in our success, we've lived in fear that someday some other news organization would realize that it's not a complicated formula. Just tell the facts, but represent both sides. Let both sides be represented so that viewers can make their decision. And, you know, at one time our tagline was, we report, you decide. And, you know, do you think there's any shot that a institution like the Washington Post, now under Bezos, who has shown that he's not afraid to at least sort of push things in different directions with his editor and some other moves that he's making, an editorial page, that they'll get there?
I think they want to, as far as people like Bezos. But remember, Warner Brothers Discovery tried to push CNN toward the middle when they hired Chris Licht, and his mandate was to moderate CNN and push it more towards journalism, and the staffers revolted. The problem is that the employees, the reporters, they don't want to be fair and balanced. So in order to change things, you have to completely clean house.
All right, I got to ask you before I run out of time here, and it's been so much fun filling. I've been getting the full Brian Kilmeade experience, by the way, Bobby. Literally doing 3 hours of Fox and Friends, and then 3 hours of the radio show. I don't see how he does it. He's like a superhuman. Nobody works harder in this business than he does. But I want to talk about what you're doing for Outkick. What are you working on?
Yeah, appreciate it. It's been this week, as you saw, the NFL has made a lot of interesting moves. They have an equity stake in ESPN now, and a lot of people are asking, well, how can ESPN cover the NFL fairly now that they are business partners? But my conclusion was, and I wrote a column last night, sports journalism has been compromised for a long time, particularly since Colin Kaepernick decided to kneel before the national anthem. I think the state of sports journalism is even in a more dire state than even political media.
Wow, that is such an interesting angle to take, and I can't wait to continue to follow your coverage on that. For me, as a Commanders fan, hoping actually that President Trump will push him to go back to the Redskins, I paid ridiculous money to get absolutely ridiculed at the playoff game with the Eagles. I'm glad I did it. I wasn't not going to do it, but I do feel like we might have a team, but I literally can't even process my brain for anything NFL until our owner pays out for Terry McLaurin, scary Terry, as they say. We're going to need him. So if you're listening out there, Josh Harris, owner of the Washington Commanders, just pay the man.
Yeah, hey, and look, as a Lions fan, you guys eliminated us prematurely last year, so I'm not on good terms with Commanders fans.
No, and everybody thought the Lions are going to do it. Who knows? It's going to be great. Listen, as always, it's great to talk to you, Bobby Burek. You can follow him at Bobby Burek. He's on Outkick, and he's got some great comms. Have a great weekend, man.
You too, Griff. Thank you.
All right, Bobby Burek. Calling in on this Friday, we've got a whole lot more coming up, and I don't want to tease it because it's so special it would blow you away. Griff Jenkins filling in on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be back.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
If we want to keep growing a population or if we want to live forever, all right, we're going to need another planet.
So is that the moon? Because
I don't want to live on the moon.
Right. Will it serve as a functional life source eventually for human beings? And B, we know how the age of colonialism worked on this planet. Should we be trying to colonize and saying that there's a keep-out zone that not other countries can participate in?
Well, the real problem with the colonization history in Western civilization is that there were people already there.
Right.
Right? There are no moon beings that were displaced.
As far as we know. As far as we know.
All right, fly me to the moon. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're wondering what you were just listening to, that was over on CBS, Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about the interim NASA administrator and Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announcing that we're going to try, the U.S. is going to be the first to build a nuclear reactor on the moon. And so the CBS anchor talking to deGrasse Tyson about, you know, what does this mean? Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, someone that could probably answer that question. And the host all of a sudden takes it to racial colonization and deGrasse just shooting him down saying, what are you talking about? The history of colonization in America and the Western world was about colonizing a place where there are already people. There's no one on the moon. But since we just talked in the last segment with Bobby Burek about bias, and then now you've got that on CBS, what an awkward out to space comment. Go figure. This is Griff Jenkins on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We've got a whole lot more. Stick with us.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
He is indeed the one and only Brian Kilmeade. I am for heretofore swearing the hardest working man in the business because I have been getting the Brian Kilmeade experience for most of this week doing 3 hours of television and 3 hours of radio. But I will say I now understand why he has so much fun. This is your humble DC correspondent, Griff Jenkins, trying to fill the giant shoes of Brian Kilmeade on the great Brian Kilmeade show. But I'll tell you, the folks that make it easy, Eric, Pete and Allison, it's such a treat to be sitting behind this microphone for a kid that started in radio, now to be behind the mic. Nothing gets better, and there's nowhere I'd rather be on an awesome Friday than with this audience talking to you from coast to coast. And we've got a busy show today. And in one of the most interesting interviews you're going to hear anywhere in the country today is with our next guest, Nate Morris. He is being billed as the man, the Republican Senate candidate in Kentucky, who might just be the next J.D. Vance. He is running to unseat and replace Kentucky's longest serving senator, Mitch McConnell. His name is Nate Morris, and he joins us on the Newsmaker line right now. Nate, happy Friday. Thanks for taking time to come on.
Thank you, Griff. It's so great to be with you and your listeners. And obviously, Griff, I've been a fan of yours for a long time, watching you early at the border and doing all the great stuff that you've been doing on reporting.
Nate, flattery will get you anywhere. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the border because, you know, look, the numbers in just 200 days, what President Trump and this administration, Tom Homan, Kristi Noem, you know, Todd Lyons with ICE, and of course, Border Patrol Chief Mike Banks, what they have been able to do as a team to get these numbers so low to zero releases into the country for three straight months after hundreds of thousands, many illegal criminal aliens being released under the Biden administration for 4 years. People like Bill Malusian, my colleague and I, that spent months on end at the border, we never thought this would be even imaginable to be at these numbers. And it's interesting because you have made immigration an important part of your campaign. You've spoke strongly and eloquently about it. You've got a tough stance in line with the Trump administration. And that's because, Nate, you fully understand that, you know, when the Biden border crisis was being billed as a border crisis for every state, you understood what that meant for Kentucky.
That's exactly right, Griff. We've had a crisis in this country for generations. This has been going on for generations. We've had Republicans and Democrats kick the can on this issue. But under Joe Biden, we reached a critical point. Griff, we got invaded. 20 million of these illegals that Joe Biden led in our country, this was an invasion of America. And I'm so proud of the leadership that we've seen from President Trump and his administration. And it shows you that leadership makes all the difference. But our campaign has said, now that we have the border sealed, now that we're working to get it sealed, we have to have a full moratorium on any new immigration coming into this country. And that means we're not going to let any new immigration happen until every one of Joe Biden's 20 million illegals are deported and they're sent home. Griff, you know this. We are full. We are absolutely full as a country. We cannot let this continue on. And Griff, as you can imagine, I've taken some heat even from one of my opponents in this primary. They called me a nativist because I want to deport every one of these illegals. They need to go home. And look, we're going to take heat even from our own party, but we have to stand strong because illegal immigration, it hurts the American worker. It hurts American families. It drives down wages. It overflows our housing. And what we saw yesterday, I think this was a great report that came from Stephen Miller, is that it's also populated our voting rolls. There could be an estimated 20 to 30 congressional seats that would flip if all these illegals would go home. So this is impacting every aspect of our society, and this is the pressing issue of the day, and we got to win it, and we got to keep showing leadership.
Yeah, and that tough stance you're taking is certainly in line with what we saw. There was a lesson, Nate, in the November election last year, which was that the 80-20, as they say, I think the numbers are higher, American voters across partisan lines from every corner of the political spectrum said enough with the Laken Rileys, enough with the Jocelyn Nungrays, enough enough with the criminal illegal aliens like we just saw here in New Jersey, in the New York area. Got behind the wheel, appears to allegedly been drunk driving with a rap sheet that included similar offenses, and killed a mother and 11-year-old daughter. Just, you know, how many reminders do we need? It will be very fascinating to your point about the election and whether it has an impact on that. As Stephen Miller says, only time will tell that. But you also talk about the American worker, and, you know, a state like Kentucky is certainly a microcosm of the American worker and the working class across the country with the industries you've got. We had, Nate, on this show earlier this week, a steel manufacturer named Drew Greenblatt. He makes steel baskets, and he's looking at these tariffs. He said, I'm all in for these tariffs. The EU deal that came about because of the tariff and trade policy of President Trump is now opening some 27 markets to his business, and it's going to encourage businesses like Japan and others to come build their plants in the U.S. to avoid the tariff altogether, and that means more jobs for American workers. He called this, Nate, the reindustrialization of America. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on Trump's trade and tariff policy.
Well, Griff, I grew up in a working class family. I was raised by a single mom. 19 of my family members worked in an auto plant, so I've lived it firsthand. When things like NAFTA happened, I had members of my family lose their job. It went to Mexico. And I'm so proud of the president because he's celebrating the American worker once again. And we have to make things in this country that can go all over the world, but also for our own security. We got to be able to make stuff in this country once again. And, Griff, we saw yesterday here in Kentucky, Apple made an announcement of a $2.5 billion investment back in American manufacturing to make stuff for Apple here in Kentucky. And what's so shocking, though, is that a lot of the politicians that were celebrating this investment from Apple opposed President Trump's tariffs, which I thought was absolutely crazy. And we've made tariffs a central part of our discussion that we're having with the people of Kentucky. We've got to back these tariffs because it is the way to level the playing field for the American worker. We have been ripped off by these foreign countries for generations. They've been taking our labor, our time, our energy, taking advantage of that, and we haven't gotten anything for it. And I think these tariffs are long overdue, and it's helping families like mine and working Kentuckians that I meet every day on the campaign trail, helping them to have a better life and ultimately live the American dream.
Yeah, that Apple announcement was obviously welcome news to all Kentuckians. And do you wonder, you know, how is it that the longest serving senator, Mitch McConnell, that, you know, ran the Senate for many, many years, and yet you didn't see a boost like that under his leadership, and all of a sudden President Trump is able to deliver that? What does that tell us?
It tells us, Griff, that we have been missing a leader the last several years. Leadership matters, and we've seen that in President Trump. And he has put a firm line in the sand that we're going to get these tariffs done. We're going to make it happen. And because of that, we're going to have more jobs in Kentucky. And that's the difference. And I think what's so disappointing about Mitch McConnell is that he was celebrating this investment yesterday, but he was against the tariffs, which I think is really, really shocking. And I think the things that President Trump is doing, it's working. And I think the average Kentuckian, they see that. They're with the president. But we've got to keep going. We've got momentum. We can't lose the momentum. That's why the 2026 election is going to be so important. We got to make sure we get people that are going to support the president and support his agenda. Because the last thing we need, Griff, is sending people to Washington that are going to fight the president from his own party. And that's what we've seen unfortunately, with a lot of our delegation in Kentucky and people around the country, they want to fight with the president. He's got the winning formula. He's an outsider. He's a business person. He's not a career politician. And I think that makes all the difference because he's lived it in the real world. He understands what real results look like, and he's pushing it from the very, very top. And I think that's why we're winning again.
You talk about this primary. It's a tight primary. You've got a lot of competition in there. It's not just about Mitch McConnell. You've also got Congressman Andy Barr and your former state attorney general, Daniel Cameron, in this race. How do you see all of this shaping up? I mean, what are your challenges in this crowded field with politicians that obviously have had some previous success?
Griff, I've never run for office before. I'm not a career politician. I'm a business person. I took about $10,000, built a business that I took public on the New York Stock Exchange for $2 billion in the trash business. And Griff, I'm sure you've watched The Sopranos. The waste business is not the nicest business to be in. And you got to be tough and you got to know how to fight. And that's what I learned as an entrepreneur. And I started something from scratch. And I saw this race unfolding. And I saw two career politicians that were the candidates. And I sat back and thought, if I don't get in this thing, we're going to get more of the same that we've had for Mitch McConnell the last 40 years. And elections have got to be about the future. They can't be defined by the past. And I said, we need something totally different. Career politicians have run this country off a cliff. If you look at our debt, if you look at the endless wars, things like Ukraine, I mean, we have people. Some of my opponents, Griff, in this election have backed gun control with Joe Biden. I mean, crazy things. I was like, we cannot have this. And what I'm so proud to say is, I don't need the job. I don't need the money. I want to go up there and fight with President Trump because I believe we've got to get our country back on track, and we need people fighting alongside the president to get it done. And we don't need people sabotaging his agenda in Washington.
You know, Nate, what I think is so fascinating about you and your candidacy is your life story, and many, to include conservative Charlie Kirk, have compared your life story to really that of J.D. Vance's, which obviously the country's very familiar with. When you hear that, what do you think? What's your response?
Well, I'm so proud of my friend J.D. Vance. I met J.D. about a decade ago, and we became buddies. We had a lot in common. Our families both descend from Appalachia. His family's from Breathitt County. Mine's from Morgan County. And we both had challenges in the home. We were both raised by single moms. We had grandparents that helped us along the way. We were fortunate that we got good education and we got opportunities. Him in venture capital, me as an entrepreneur in the technology world. And we had a lot of intersections. And it was kind of a long-lost family member or friend when we connected because of the similarities. And I've been inspired by what he's done, Griff. I mean, he went up to the Senate, shook it up, obviously saw so much talent and leadership, I think the president did in him, that he made him the vice president. And I think he's one of the best vice presidents already in history. And I think he's going to continue to make history. And I believe he's got an unlimited future of what he's going to accomplish for this country. And I'm so proud to know him. And I'm inspired by that and taking a lot of cues in the way that we're running our race. But I think these stories, like JD's, like my family story, this is the story of most Kentuckians. Most Kentuckians that I meet, they've been fighting since as long as they can remember. They've been dealing with the opioid crisis. They've been dealing with NAFTA taking their job. They've been dealing with having to fight through all the nonsense that these career politicians put on them and wondering, how are we going to get out of this trillions of dollars of debt that we have? These are questions that working folks talk about every day that I meet on the trail. And these are people like my family. And so I'm proud that to know JD. And one of the things we talked about this race is that we understand what it's like. We understand what it's like to struggle and to have to fight for everything you've got. And we need more people like that in politics who are steeped in reality, not in a vacuum of Washington, D.C., influenced by all the stuff that they see. Because, Griff, we know this. The longer you're in Washington, D.C., it's a corruptible thing. And people get worse and worse as they're in Washington, D.C. And so that's one of the things I've made central to my campaign is we need term limits. Two terms is enough for a seat like this. You do your work, you serve, and then you come back home and you become a citizen like everybody else. And that's one of the things that I think has been so pervasive in our culture and politics. And it's gotten this country in big, big trouble, and we got to stop it.
It sure has. And serving the American people, getting results. I've got to take a break, Nate. I don't want to put you in a tight spot, but do you have just a few more minutes?
Absolutely, Griff.
Okay, great. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to Nate Morris. He is a Senate candidate in Kentucky looking to unseat the long-serving Mitch McConnell. Fascinating interview. A fascinating candidate. Nate Morris joining us on the other side of this break. I'm Griff Jenkins in for Brian Kilmeade. We'll be back.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It makes you think indeed. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show, and we are fortunate to have joining us here for another segment. I kept him over. I won't keep you long, Mr. Morris. I know you've got a lot of campaigning to do, but Nate Morris is a Senate candidate in Kentucky looking to replace the long-running Mitch McConnell out there in a crowded primary. And, Nate, you were just really intriguing me. You were talking about how similar your life story is to J.D. Vance, your friendship, and the inspiration you drew from him. And it's very fascinating, sort of in the larger picture of all of this, President Trump sort of not backing down from saying that J.D. Vance might be the heir apparent to carry on the MAGA torch, and we certainly have seen J.D. Vance as president, as vice president, doing just remarkably large things, like that conference early on in Munich where he went and put Europe on notice that your socialist ways have got to go, otherwise we're going to let you literally wither and die by your own poor decisions. And we'll see where that goes. But as we look at the similarities between you and J.D. Vance and sort of your alignment with President Trump, Vice President Vance, and then sort of the MAGA movement, how do you see ultimately, if you make it to the governor's mansion, what you want to do for the state of Kentucky?
Well, first and foremost, I want to bring an outside perspective. I'm not a career politician. I've never run for office before. And we can't have more of the same. Mitch McConnell has been in that seat for 40 years. And again, I'm for term limits. I think two terms is enough. And we've got to have new blood. We've got to have a fresh perspective. But I think immigration is at the top of the list. That's why I've called for the full moratorium on any new immigration into our country. Griff, I believe that amnesty is treason. Amnesty is treason. And we have to look at it as treason. Anyone who says otherwise is letting America go down the tubes. And one of the things that I'm very proud that J.D. said was that the U.K. is one example. They've lost their country. In 10 years, he said, the U.K. will be the first Islamic nation to have a nuclear weapon. And the thinking that got U.K. in the position that it is, that lost their country, is the same kind of thinking that a lot of Democrats and some Republicans have.
Yep.
About the way they see immigration. If we lose our country because of an open border and not sending these illegals back,
yeah.
This is the last bastion of Western thought and Western civilization in this world.
Fascinating stuff. His name is Nate Morris. Thank you for taking time, Nate. Have a great weekend. Good luck in the campaign. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be right back.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear it all, and how lucky are your ears getting to listen to the greatest radio show in America, the Brian Kilmeade Show. How about that? It's Griff Jenkins, your humble D.C. correspondent, filling in for Brian. Brian on a much-deserved time off, and me, just a kid in a candy store getting to sit in behind the microphone for Brian. You know, I do want to take a moment to go down, you know, the rabbit hole of something that makes I'm very fascinated in. Just to be blunt about it, I really was struck by this interview because I am a reporter. That's my day job. I'm a correspondent in Washington, D.C. You've seen me on the border and in hurricanes and in riots and covering Capitol Hill. Sometimes I'm at the White House. And, you know, journalism, they say journalism is dead. It's not dead. It's just obviously, as all of our listeners who are also news consumers realize, that there has been some pretty blatant bias on the part of the mainstream media. I'm sort of stating the obvious, and there's no shortage of examples of that. But what was interesting to me, and because I've lived in Washington – since 1993. And I've read the Washington Post all of those years to always know what's going on. And in the local news, it's a great source to know what's happening as well. But when this podcast, Mark Halperin, who many of you know as a longtime political analyst and journalist in his own right, Mark Halperin did an interview on his podcast. That's his newest thing. He has a podcast called Next Up with Mark Halperin. He interviewed Glenn Kessler. Glenn Kessler was at the Post, Washington Post, for more than 20 years. For at least 15 or so, he was known as the fact checker. Well, as they say, the facts will set you free, and something set Glenn Kessler free because he is out of there. And in the podcast with Halperin, they talked about everything about bias in the Washington Post newsroom. We played a little bit of that earlier this hour with our interview with Bobby Burak. But I want to go a little deeper into it, because one of the things that is really going to be a stain on journalists in the mainstream, and particularly on a paper like the Washington Post, remember, who gained Watergate fame for doing the part of the call of journalism to hold the powerful accountable, as they did back during Nixon in the Watergate days. The big story that many will see in the rearview mirror of the Biden administration was Joe Biden's mental acuity and the rapid decline that was apparent to the entire country. And yet, how did the Post cover it? Well, not really at all. And Halperin and Kessler got into that. Listen to this. This is Cut 29.
There was a lot of effort to produce a story that would look very carefully at what seemed to be a cognitive decline. It never came together because we couldn't get enough people on the record.
Glenn, do you know the moment where Joe Biden spoke to a dead congresswoman at a public event? Are you familiar with that moment?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what kind of sourcing did you need to say Joe Biden was suffering cognitive decline? Did you see him trailing off regularly? What kind of sourcing was needed?
I can't get too deep in the weeds of what happened at my former news.
But you weren't in all the meetings, but you read the coverage. You read the coverage.
I'm telling you, there was a lot of effort to produce the story, that you are asking for, and it didn't come together. That is my understanding. I was not
okay.
In the meetings.
Understood.
Yes, in retrospect, one could say, God, that was a real missed opportunity. It's also difficult when you're taking on the president of the United States and saying, and you want to say, okay, we think there's a cognitive decline, and we want to get people on the record as actually saying this. I mean, and because it's a very serious accusation.
So how about that? Mark Halperin holding Glenn to task. Glenn, come on. You know how this works. And Kessler really was sort of tap dancing, trying to get around that. But to Halperin's point, how many examples did the Washington Post need? What about he's over in Normandy and he's wandering off into fields or in Italy? There's just no shortage of things that would have been the opportunity to cover it and, to go a little deeper so that you can see things from my perspective. And I'm not unique as a reporter. There are things that the public see. There are moments, particularly when a president does something that, you may not have the president's physician going on record saying that the guy is out to the pasture and that there's a massive mental cognitive decline, but yet at the same time, the coverage at best was non-existent, at worst apologetic, making up excuses for why, but the lack thereof and the omission of covering what in hindsight was maybe the most significant part of the Biden legacy, the mental decline. And we've got, obviously, now, thanks to Chairman James Comer of the Oversight Committee, an actual deep dive into the auto pen, and the mental decline, calling up all of these individuals that were within the Biden inner circle. We just had yesterday Anita Dunn, very close to the inner circle, a key part of that inner circle, who actually didn't plead the fifth, talked a little bit about what she saw, defended the president, but at least we got a little bit of a window. Now you've at least got the House committee trying to dive into it. We're going to actually get a chance to talk to Byron Donalds, congressman who's on that committee that's been diving into it. And we're going to talk more about that. But I wanted to play that clip for you because it became very apparent that there was a massive cognitive decline of the former President Joe Biden. And yet the hometown paper that got famous for holding a President Nixon to account in Watergate was absent, was nowhere to be seen. Radio silence when it came to Biden's cognitive decline. And I do give kudos to Mark Halperin for holding Glenn Kessler, the previous fact checker, to account for his paper's lack of coverage thereof. This is Griff Jenkins on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We've got a whole lot more coming up. Stay with us.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Ain't no werewolves in London up in here in the Brian Kilmeade radio studio, but you do have Griff Jenkins, your humble DC correspondent, trying to live up to the great shoes of Brian Kilmeade. So much fun being here, getting to talk about everything and getting to go on this rant about the Washington Post and, you know, hearing from the supposed longtime fact checker Glenn Kessler, talking with Mark Halperin and being held to account about what was happening there. And I promise I will eventually get off this story, but it is important, and you may not hear it anywhere other than the Brian Kilmeade Show, but it's worth our listeners hearing that you know, as the Washington Post under Jeff Bezos tries to find their way, and whether they can get there by appealing to a wider audience in a more fair journalistic manner, it's quite fascinating to hear Mark Halperin just grill Glenn Kessler. And ultimately, what it boils down to is that whether you have to be honest about answering the question about whether or not that paper, or any news organization for that matter, had a newsroom full of people with pre-existing biases. Here is a little bit more of that interview, cut 32.
I believe people come to the news coverage with a pre-existing bias that they are going to be against Republicans and for Democrats, when I would argue that is not the case.
Right. And that's despite...
And people will look at things through their pre-existing bias
lenses. Right. Okay. And that's despite Krautheimer and George Will and other conservatives. And as you pointed out, Fred Hyatt's relatively moderate centrist editorial page, despite that, the liberal, like the Eugene Robinsons of the world, caused them to think of the Post as a liberal place. And that's the reason.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay.
So there you go. I had to get that out as a journalist myself and someone that is a reporter in D.C. That's, you know, the Washington Post trying to find their way. But I want to set that aside because we are very excited right now to have the Secretary of HUD, Scott Turner, joining us right now. He is a remarkable secretary, a good friend, and I certainly remember him as one of the great cornerbacks for the Washington Redskins back in the day. Mr. Secretary, thank you for calling in. I've been on a rant about this interview that the fact checker had done with Mark Halperin, where Kessler was trying to basically weasel out of the fact that, well, there's no bias in the newsroom, and so I don't want to throw you into that conversation. Except for how about one quick question, and that is, has the Washington Post been very fair and good covering all of the great work that HUD has been doing the last 200 days?
Well, good morning, Griff. Great to be with you, sir, and excited to join in the conversation. You know, I think overall, you know, we have very few media outlets that are fair and balanced in covering the great work that's been done. I mean, you have some that want to suppress the great work, you know, and not let the people know really what's been the transformational actions that have taken place. And, you know, the Washington Post, albeit I don't pay very much attention to what they do, as I have a great assignment and a big job here at HUD. But I would say that very few of them cover what's going on in a fair way.
Such a shame, too, because in just 200 days with you as secretary under President Trump's leadership, you've had remarkable success on the housing front. It's certainly something that deserves to be in the news and on the front page of the Washington Post. Tell us, I just want to give you a chance to sort of sound off on many of the accomplishments that you've been able to make there at HUD.
Well, thank you, Griff. You know it. When you look at the mission, and one thing we are very focused on at HUD is returning to a mission-minded focus. We know who we've been called to serve. We know the mission that we've been called to carry out. And so we're laser-focused on that and really delivering real results, tangible results to the American people in the communities that we serve, rural, tribal, and urban. And you think about, you know, we've been tearing down burdensome regulations like the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule that was crippling development in our country, and working on taking down more burdensome, onerous regulations so that we can free up building and development in our country, where we need 7 million units of housing of all types. And so tearing these regulations down from a federal standpoint, working with our local and state partners to also take inventory and take those burdensome regulations down, will help us to continue to build affordable housing. And more recently here, you saw the president signed an executive order to end crime and disorder on America's streets. And this EO really highlights the failed policy of housing first. You know, when it comes to homelessness, we want to look at homelessness from a holistic standpoint, to treat really the root of homelessness, to look at the mental illness, to look at the substance use disorder. And so historically, Griff, homelessness has been defined and has been graded successful the more people that you have in the homeless shelter. But HUD is no longer going to define success that way. We'll define success from the quality of service that we provide, and also the amount of people that we launch out of homelessness into a life of self-sustainability. And so cutting red tape, taking down burdensome regulations, having a different paradigm as it relates to homelessness, and also our youth initiative, our foster youth initiative that we partnered with the First Lady on. You know, Dr. Ben Carson, when he was the secretary, started this foster youth initiative, and we have invested over $5 million in serving the youth of our country so that when they age out, they have a solid place to land as it pertains to housing, so they can concentrate on their education, on their family formation, on their career. And so I'm excited about this, and we've allocated $25 million, Griff, in HUD's budget, working with the First Lady to help our foster youth. And so just in those 200 days, then you have the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which I know you want to talk about, which has been transformational for our country, including opportunity zones.
Well, and I think it's so fascinating, the opportunity zones and what's in the Big Beautiful Bill. And you're right, I had to squeeze this in because, you know, Mr. Secretary, I moved to Washington in 1993. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'd never lived in a city that had a professional sports team, an NFL team. And so I get to Washington, I'm like, I've got the Washington Redskins. I can't believe it. And so I bought tickets in the nosebleed. It's all I could afford. But I got to watch one of the greatest cornerbacks in NFL for the Washington Redskins, now Commanders, in Scott Turner play. And I went to the last game in RFK Stadium when they played the Cowboys and beat them. Actually, just my birthday is December 15th. It was like the day before or after. I can't exactly remember. But, you know, there's now talk of returning to RFK, bringing the Washington team back there to RFK in that area. And that area is actually, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, in an opportunity zone.
Yes, sir. Griff, that's a great memory, by the way. I remember that game all too well. And so thank you for bringing that back. That put a smile on my face. But, yes, we're RFK Stadium, the beloved RFK Stadium, the home of the the Redskins, where I was drafted. RFK is indeed there in the opportunity zone. And as you saw, the owner of the Commanders, Josh Harris, and his team working with the city to bring the team, to bring the stadium back there, which will bring great community revitalization, bring new life to the area and mixed-use development, 6,000 units of housing, economic opportunity, new jobs. But I will say as a caveat here, that the city of D.C. must get the crime in that area under control, must get support for law enforcement and start to rein in on crime so that this revitalization can truly take place, because Opportunity Zone policy is a transformative policy, but we got to get the crime in order.
You sure do. And you know, here's looking at you, Mayor Muriel Bowser. You can do it. You got to get it done. It's got to happen. And just before I run out of time, I've only got like a minute left, Mr. Secretary, but I got to ask you. So, you know, there's all this talk. President Trump says he would like to see the name returned to the Redskins. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, you know, I do. You know, I'm a Redskin fan. That team is very endearing to me. That's where I got my start, was at the Washington Redskins. And you know as well as I do, when they changed the name, it was under this odd and bad circumstances. I think that many people love the name Redskins. I believe the tribes were honored to have the Redskins as the logo and the mascot for this professional football team. So I would love to see that name come back. I'm a great supporter of Josh and the ownership and those players and all really the NFL. But that would be tremendous to bring the name back. But then more importantly, to bring economic development and opportunity back to that city.
If they bring the name back and the team back to RFK Stadium, I am going to demand, if they don't already have plans to do it, to bring Scott Turner, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, but once one of the greatest cornerbacks of that legendary 90s team, back to that stadium. Mr. Secretary, it was such an honor and pleasure speaking with you. Have a great weekend and keep up the great work.
Okay, you too, Griff. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. That's HUD Secretary Scott Turner joining us. He says bring the Redskins name back. How about that? I say I'm on board with you. I'm Griff Jenkins in for the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be back.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
One of the fastest growing and one of the strongest, most powerful radio shows in the country. Number three, according to Talkers Magazine and Michael Harrison over there. But there's no better show to listen to. You will listen. You will learn. You will hear things that you have not heard anywhere else because of how well Brian Kilmeade does it. He has well-deserved time off. Your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, filling in and living the dream, the Brian Kilmeade experience of 3 hours of television in the morning, 3 hours of radio in the midday. And I'll tell you, I don't know how he does it, but one thing that I have learned in the 3 days I've been filling in here is that he has the best guest. And we are so fortunate right now to bring in one of my absolute favorite members of Congress and likely the next governor of the state of Florida. He is always available to the press. He knows what's happening. He's a massive rising star, if not already huge star in the Republican Party. And that is Congressman Byron Donalds. Congressman, happy Friday. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Griff, it's good to be with you.
It is always great to have you. Your insights are so strong, and particularly, our viewers on Fox may have remembered, I've covered occasionally when some of these members of Biden's former inner circle have come, a half a dozen or more now, that have some claiming the fifth, others a little bit more forthcoming, have come before your oversight
committee with Chairman James Comer, and you and I have talked in the halls. You even made a lot of news one day when we were talking to Jill Biden's former work husband, Anthony Bernal, and you said, look, we need the former first lady maybe to be called. And now we just had yesterday, you guys had Anita Dunn up there, and my colleague, Aisha Hosni, tried to get some answers from Anita Dunn. I don't know if you saw this, Congressman, but here's a little bit of how that one-sided conversation went. Listen.
Were you against doing a cognitive test for President Biden? Were you afraid of sharing any of the results from a cognitive test? Would you have supported a cognitive test if the doctor would have approved of it? Do you think the president was fit to serve for another 4 years? Ms. Dunn, do you have anything to say about what Anthony Bernal said about you? He called you disloyal in a new book. Do you have anything to say in response to that? Are you disloyal to the Biden family? Ms. Dunn, why should voters trust Democrats in the White House again?
And that ding there is, of course, saved by the elevator, as they say. So she was, you know, cat got her tongue with Aisha. But Congressman, take us inside the hearing room. Did she have any answer to the cognitive test?
I mean, look, she actually had answers around, you know, she was able to make her statement. The full transcript's not going to be released yet. And so, you know, we're going to continue to go through that. But I think it's indicative of the bigger issue we have is that, you know, she might answer some questions. Anthony Bernal pleads the fifth. The White House doctor pleads the fifth. And so, you know, it's really hard to tell what was truthful and what was not, which is why we have to continue with our investigation. I know my colleague from North Carolina, Pat Harrigan, he was there yesterday in the hearing, in the closed door questioning with Anita Dunn, and you know, he came out and basically said he didn't really seem that believable to me. So there's a lot of questions here. Like, we're just getting started, Griff, and people will say, well, who's going to be held accountable? What's the outcome of all this? The outcome, first and foremost, is you have to have transparency. And then number two, if there were any crimes that were actually committed, that stuff has to be referred to the Department of Justice. We're going to continue our investigations, and we're just getting started.
Well, and Congressman, I think really as the country watches this, they obviously want to know all the details they can about what those aides knew about the president's cognitive decline and, you know, if the auto pen was used improperly or even illegally. But the big question ultimately is, who was running the country, particularly at the end of Biden's term? And are you satisfied that you've gotten answers that tell us really ultimately who was in charge?
No, I'm not satisfied. And that's why we have a lot more work to do. And I think, like, if you take this auto pen scandal in and of itself, that's one thing. But when you add to it Russiagate, when you add to it Operation Choke Point, when you add to it Operation Choke Point 2.0, what we're seeing here is a constant modus operandi of the Democrats when they have power. And that is, they are subverting, in my opinion, they do subvert the law. Number two, they hide and they lie from the American people. They lack transparency, even a scintilla of transparency. And three, they're quick to try to drop stories or to defame other people. But when they get questioned, they clam up. They don't talk to the press. They don't provide the information to the American people. So the American people can look at them and say, you know what, maybe these people are trustworthy. So I think the Democrats here, they have a responsibility to come clean on this, because it's going to be very important if they think that they're going to earn the trust of the American people. You got to be able to tell us the truth about Joe Biden's mental decline. This is simple stuff. If you can't tell us that truth, then what else are you hiding?
Exactly, Congressman. And you mentioned the Russia hoax and Russiagate, and that's fascinating as well, because, you know, as someone in the media watching this play out, it's a little bit confusing. I mean, I'm dumbfounded that other media organizations haven't given the slightest attention to the Russiagate. I mean, we had, obviously, the quick recap on this. You had DNI Tulsi Gabbard come out and declassify all of these documents that show us really what was happening around around there that has created major questions and potential legal problems for people like John Brennan and James Comey. Then, of course, that moved into the referrals to the DOJ with a strike force looking into it, and now a grand jury impaneled to look at this stuff. But yet so many of the other, you know, you try and get any coverage of this on some of the other cable networks, and they are just dismissing it as all about nothing. There's nothing there. What do you say?
The reason why they're saying that is because they were part of it. I mean, let's be very clear. When the intelligence review was ordered by Barack Obama, John Brennan and James Clapper are preparing that document. And when they're walking in to meet with then President Barack Obama about their new findings, which had no basis in fact, they were also leaking it to the press. This is the same press that was running that story ad nauseum in the lame duck session right before Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president. And they were running this story as if it was fact. And they were being used, or B, being complicit with the Obama regime. So that's why they're saying there's nothing to see here, because if they actually report on a story, what it demonstrates is their own lack of credibility when it comes to delivering honest news to the American people. Like, I don't think the mainstream media has much credibility left anyway, but the reason they won't cover this is because it further diminishes whatever credibility they have.
And they've got to realize that if actual indictments came out of a grand jury being impaneled, they're going to be forced to cover it. And so it's straight to your point about this, and it could end up causing them to really look foolish and you know, irresponsible in how they covered it or lack thereof before. Hey, let me, while I've got you, I want to shift gears just a little bit, because you are running for governor of Florida, and we're seeing now down there, we just learned here in the last 24 hours, this federal judge moving to halt the construction of Alligator Alcatraz, this, you know, state detention facility that's holding these particularly many violent illegal alien criminals down there that are also being deported quickly. They're not staying there for long periods of time. This was set up by the current Governor DeSantis to try and supplement and help work and partner state partnership with federal immigration law enforcement to help the Trump administration carry out their goal that was a major mandate of the election last November to shut down the border and remove these criminals from our streets. What was your reaction to that ruling, this whole situation? And, you know, this could be something that you're at one day dealing with.
Well, first, let's say right here, Alligator Alcatraz is still open and running currently. I believe they were trying to add on to the facility, and a couple of environmentalist groups have sued in federal court to halt that construction of an addition to the current facility. So this lawsuit, you know, I'm quite sure the governor and the attorney general, they'll work through this very quickly, win this case, and finish the addition to Alligator Alcatraz. In terms of its core functions, it's operating as intended right now. And I know they're doing a new one in Indiana, a similar facility in Indiana, once being open. But at the end of the day, we are going to continue to work with President Trump to make sure that we help him deliver his promises that he made to the American people around sending home criminal illegal aliens and deporting a lot of these illegal aliens that came in the country during the last 4 years.
Well, and, you know, as a congressman, you've certainly have dealt with the border crisis that we all live through. God knows I spent weeks and months at the border covering the thousands pouring across. And, you know, I've had the privilege and opportunity to do some hosting on Fox and Friends as well. And here and there, I've been talking about, you know, how stunning, now that we're at this 200 day mark with the Trump administration, stunning just how much that the president and his administration, Kristi Noem, Tom Homan, have been able to get this down, to get these numbers down to zero releases for 3 months in a row internally in the country, when Biden was releasing hundreds of thousands, many of them hardened criminals coming from other countries. And then, of course, now the remarkable number of apprehensions that ICE is making internally. What are your thoughts on it?
And my thoughts are is that when you have professionals in the White House, in the administration, who are following the law, these are the results. So it's once and for all, it makes it clear. Federal law is what we need to secure the southern border. We already have that on the books. What you have to have is the will and the people you elect to actually execute that mission and get the job done. That's what it demonstrates. Now we got to do the hard work, because Joe Biden let in 10, 12, 15 million people into the United States. A lot of them have to go home. And I think, you know, while we have these other conversations around immigration raids, et cetera, we have to remember as a country that you cannot allow Democrats to allow invasions of illegal aliens. And then when Republicans take over, then they say, well, you can't send people back. It's outrageous. It's not right to the American people, to the welfare of the American people overall. And so now we begin the process of deportations. But the border is secured because we have a president who is committed to securing the nation and not talking about it and not lying to the American people about our border situation.
Yeah, and to your point, you've got DHS Secretary Kristi Noem very frequently, and today no exception, talking about the worst of the worst. You know, that worst of the worst being removed from the country isn't just some sort of political slogan. It's actual facts when you look at the number of convicted murderers, child rapists, and other hardened criminals that are being removed. And it's really, I've said this before and I'll say it again, it's beside me that this isn't a bipartisan issue, yet you've got Democrats continuing to double down, some colleagues of yours across the aisle, to include the minority leader of the Democratic Party, Hakeem Jeffries, continuing to label them as Nazis, likening them to Gestapo. That's over the top. You got to agree with me there.
Oh, it is over the top. But the reason why the Democrats do that is because they learned their lessons from Saul Alinsky quite well. Pick a target, personalize it, and polarize it. So you have ICE agents, they're Hispanic, they're Black, they're white, they're trying to just do their jobs. But you have the Democrats calling them Nazis and Gestapo. It's sick and it's outrageous. But these are the same Democrats who had no problem with the drug cartels making billions and billions of dollars trafficking people into the United States illegally and trafficking fentanyl into the United States illegally. When it came to that, they had nothing wrong to say, because they were accomplishing their political ends, which was open borders and a destabilization of the United States. But when you try to bring law and order, then they go back and try to call everybody a member of the Third Reich. This is what the Democrats do. They don't have solutions. All they have is inflamed political rhetoric to try to get people to be emotional about what needs to happen in this country or what's happening in this country, as opposed to being factual about what the real solutions are and what the policies that are needed to provide a significantly better way of life for the people of the United States compared to other people around the globe.
And I think you're right. The American people are largely not behind the Democrats doubling down on defending criminal aliens. It's just mind-boggling. Congressman Byron Donalds, one of my favorite members of Congress, doing great work. Can't wait to see where this Oversight Committee investigation of the auto pen goes. And good luck on your gubernatorial race down there in the Sunshine State. Appreciate your time. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Griff. Take it easy.
All right. Congressman Byron Donalds taking time to join us on this Friday, having far too much fun than any human should be allowed. Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade on The Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Getting you talking, and in the famous words of Al Pacino in A Scene from a Woman, we're just getting started. I'm Griff Jenkins, your humble D.C. correspondent, filling in for Brian Kilmeade on The Brian Kilmeade Show. You know, as a guy that lives in Washington and I get to come spend time hosting shows in New York City, the one story I cannot get away from is what this great city, the largest, most powerful city in the country, New York City, the prospect that they are about to elect the most socialist, progressive, mayor in the history of the city, in Zoran Mamdani. And Zoran Mamdani, obviously long well known and documented, are his anti-Semitic, anti-police, anti-capitalist, the list goes on, the statements that he has made, but yet he ended up winning the primary and is on his way. Now, there have been reports that he, that President Trump is now gotten interested in this race, concerned for the future of New York City. No doubt probably is the case, as many observers share that sentiment, but there were reports, rumblings that President Trump was in some way coordinating with former governor and mayoral candidate Andrew Cuomo to try and stop. Can anybody stop Zoran Mamdani? Mamdani has taken the very predictable page out of the Democrat Progressive playbook now in zeroing in on trying to pick a fight with President Trump. And he says now that Trump is going to find out that Mamdani is going to be Trump's worst nightmare. Listen.
My administration would be Donald Trump's worst nightmare. And you don't need to take me at my word or take Andrew Cuomo at his. You need only look at the actions of the Trump administration since I won the Democratic primary.
So there you go. That's just a little bit of what Mamdani has to say. We've got a lot more. I'm going to bring it because we are going to talk next to Pierre Debas, a managing partner of real estate firm here. He has a lot of thoughts on the direction of New York City. He loves the Big Apple, and we're going to hear from him, Pierre Debas, coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stick with us. I'm Griff Jenkins.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It does make your head spin, particularly if you try and live the Brian Kilmeade experience doing 3 hours of TV, 3 hours of radio, and everything else that comes down the pike. But man, how much fun it is. I'll tell you that. Griff Jenkins here filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show. And right now, we're very lucky to have Pierre Debas, a managing partner of Romer Debas, a highly involved real estate guy here, knows what's happening in the Big Apple. And Pierre, it's great to have the opportunity. I know you're a friend of the show, and I was excited to get to talk to you because, you know, I've lived for the last 3.5 decades in Washington, D.C., and, you know, the prospect of a far-left, progressive, self-avowed socialist, Zoran Mamdani, actually getting elected, which by all accounts looks, seems to be on the path to becoming, certainly won the primary, is something that just, I can't imagine what it must be like for people that love and live in New York City. Thanks for joining the show. Let me just get your initial thoughts on the Mamdani situation.
Griff, it's good to see you. You know, to put it bluntly, it's sheer lunacy. The problem that you have now is that the younger generation buys into the false hopes of socialism and democratic socialism. I like to call it democratic communism, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, the issue is these young voters are the ones going out and vote, right? They saddled student debt, they come into the workforce, they can't find jobs. Quite frankly, it's a generational problem because the majority of them weren't really raised in the way that we were in terms of working hard and having goals and aspiring and doing whatever you have to do to work to achieve those goals, right? These kids believe in a lot of handouts. Now, do we have problems in New York City? Do we have social issues? Do we have income inequality? Do we need to increase affordability? Absolutely. But this isn't the way to do it, right? This is a massive, massive disaster for New York City and will drive out the income base that you need to pay for all these things, right? Socialism's great, right? It's nice that I have free stuff for everybody. Free supermarkets, free daycare,
free
this,
like free
right?
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds great, Griff, right? But who's paying for it, right? The government derives income from where? Tax revenue. If you don't have the people here to tax to create the revenue to pay for these things, then really it's just nonsense. And that's the problem, right? It's a lot of false advertisement is a polite way of putting it. And it's not going to work. And I think that the younger generation has to realize that. And most importantly, the, you know, demographic that is really going to be impacted by this has to go ahead and vote. New Yorkers don't vote. I mean, how do you have the financial capital of the world and you have 8 years of Bill de Blasio, the worst mayor in New York City history, and quite honestly, our first socialist that we had running the city?
Well, and, you know, look, Mamdani, by all accounts, is far to the left of de Blasio, looks like a centrist Democrat at some of the things he's saying. But, you know, Pierre, you hit on something that I'm really glad you brought up, which is the tax base, because, you know, the very obvious stuff is obviously his anti-Semitic views, his anti-law enforcement views, his anti-ICE, pro-illegal criminal alien views. The list goes on and on. But when you talk about really the core of the threat he would be in New York City, I think you put your finger right on it. And I was fascinated when I watched Senator Elizabeth Warren on CNBC sparring with the host trying to defend Mamdani's tax base. I know you've watched it, but for our listeners, I want them to hear it and then have you respond, because I think you really are zeroing in on what is really a key part of what's at stake. Listen here.
What Zohran is saying is, I want people to be able to afford to live in New York City. That's what keeps it a vibrant city. That's what makes people want to live
Nobody
here.
Nobody disagrees with that, Senator, but raising taxes in order to do it? Why is that
goodness.
The answer?
Oh, dear. Are you worried that billionaires are going to go hungry?
No, I'm worried that they're going to leave and spend their money elsewhere.
You know, they've threatened to do that over and over and over.
And they have. They've left.
So, that's it. Kudos to the CNBC host there to push on her to say, wait a minute, you're literally going to run people out of the Big Apple.
They don't want to learn from their mistakes. You know, go back to 2020, and I say this every day. The exodus of people from New York City wasn't driven by the pandemic predominantly. It's driven by the terrible policies of the de Blasio administration. They defunded the police $1 billion. And what did we have? We had a 50% increase in crime in a matter of a year. You know, New York City is one of the most expensive cities in the world. You're never going to make it, you know, affordable for everybody under the sun. You can help make progress, increase affordability by incentivizing affordable housing. But I will tell you, we saw this. You have to learn from your mistakes. People did leave. People will leave again. You know, the pandemic has shown us you don't have to be physically in the financial capital of the world for 365 days a year in order to run a business. You're able, I mean, take a look at Chicago, take a look at San Francisco, you know, use them as case studies. These cities are crumbling. They're crumbling because of horrific public policy and leadership. New York City cannot afford to have this happen. We're already, it will take us a decade to make up for the repair that the de Blasio administration caused for us. A decade will take us to make up. If you add this lunatic to the equation, good God, how many decades it'll take. I don't even know if the repair will be, I don't even know if it'll be repairable.
You know, and it's fascinating. I mean, I have said that, you know, there's a scenario here that maybe what's happening a little bit when you hear Senator Warren out there doing this sort of bidding for Mamdani and trying to make it sound good. You know, she's a progressive that has for years perfected the art of trying to appeal to the socialist side of things. You know, right. Bernie Sanders, AOC, there's a few out there. But when you see that with Sanders, you have to wonder, is this the progressive left, the Sanders, the Warren crowd saying, let's start with New York City and then it'll go elsewhere? You've got other cities. You've got Omar Fatah out in Minneapolis, same cut from the same cloth as Mamdani. And then now Katie Wilson out in Seattle, looks like she may be in the lead out there. She's progressive, saying some of the same things. It may not even be just New York City that's at risk.
No, and when you look at the election, take the election as an example. Trump won all of the swing states, right? He won every single swing state. You know, I say this all the time. In my humble opinion, 80% of society lies between center left and center right. That's where majority of us live. You have to get back there. You continue going further and further. Learn from the mistakes. Learn from the election, right? You push this progressive stuff. People don't want it. Vast majority does not want it. It's great marketing. You mentioned AOC and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. I don't know what the hell they've accomplished. But they sounds great. You know, people are buying into it. It's phenomenal marketing. I don't think they've really done anything. And I think people have to wake up and realize that it's all smoke and mirrors. Get back to being the center left, center right. Get back to common sense. You know, if I can use an example, Griff, you know, when you talk about, you know, people leaving New York City, Mamdani's housing plan is something that I love zeroing in on, because I just coined the phrase destruction by design. When you talk about freezing rents, yeah, it sounds great. I'm going to freeze rents and people. And he does not believe in the private ownership of property, right? Does not believe in it. Now, can the government go and seize your property unilaterally and arbitrarily? No, they can't. But what they can do is regulate the hell out of it to drive the values down and to align themselves in this position where they'd be the only one to want to acquire these properties and create socialized housing. So this started in 2019 when de Blasio changed our rent regulations. The drastic change in rent regs made it a complete disincentivizer for landlords to improve properties because they were not able to increase rents to get an ROI on any investment they put in them. So we have a lot of dilapidated housing, and we have about 100,000 units of shadow inventory that's not even on the market. Now, this guy wants to come in and compound the problem and freeze rents. When de Blasio's rent regs drove down value of stabilized buildings by roughly 50%. New York City has over a million rent-stabilized units. That's a lot of affordable housing for a city, yeah, right? We use more, but you only get more by incentivizing development. Now, this guy wants to come in, freeze these rents. You've already had a 50% reduction in value. You freeze rents and you bring this radical person as your mayor. Values now go from 50% probably to maybe 10 cents on the dollar. And then you know what? He is primed to swipe in, and he's posted videos of this. They refers to the Vienna model, where you come in and you create private land trust for the government to acquire these properties and create socialized housing. And he has a nice smile and a charming voice. People don't see through it. It is flat out communism. That's what this is. And that's why I'm so adamant about fighting against this. It's a taking of property through destruction by design. And people have to wake up and see that. It sounds crafty. It sounds nice. It is flat out communism. And that's his housing plan. So if that plan goes into effect and that's your leadership, you tell me one sane person that's going to invest a dollar in New York City. You tell me one sane person.
Yeah, right. And you wonder too, Pierre, if wealthy liberal elites that live in penthouses on the Upper East Side in buildings with a doorman who intend to plan to vote for Mamdani know that Mamdani plans to move them out of their house.
You have to look past just party, in my opinion. You have to look past party and actually dive into what these people are saying. You know, the problems are society, or society became part one that just votes based off of party, especially New York City. That's always been the case. That's why I'm an advocate of Sliwa dropping out. He has no chance of winning.
Right.
Cuomo, ridiculous. He ran in the first place, being an impeached governor. You know, Adams, I say it all the time. Like, I don't think he's done a great job, but like, sadly, he's the least of the evils, right? Like, it's pathetic that the most important city in the world, you're voting based on least of the evils, as opposed to somebody you believe in.
Is he though? I mean, you know, I think you're exactly right. Look, with Adams, Cuomo, and Sliwa in the race, it's Mamdani. The political math isn't hard. And, the Sliwa voters, the Republicans, are going to be the first to vote for anyone other than Mamdani. And so Sliwa has a real tough decision to make here. But I was reading David Marcus, a columnist for the New York Times, was saying that he believes Cuomo has really the best shot, that ultimately, you know, as he wrote, which is pretty interesting, he said, you know, there's nothing to the left of Mamdani. Really, the only thing that's there is old-fashioned food shortage communism. And a lot of critics say that Mamdani is actually there as well. So you can't go any farther. You're just against the progressive socialism communism wall. And he believes that it is if Cuomo can track to the center, get a center lane and carve it out, he might be the best to try and make it happen. And now we're hearing these reports and rumblings that possibly President Trump is getting interested in the race, in stopping Mamdani and coordinating in some way with Cuomo. To be fair, Cuomo and Trump have both said, no, neither of us have talked to each other. We're not coordinating. And Cuomo is going to have a very immediate tall task, I would submit to you, in knocking off the Trump criticism pretty damn quickly if for some reason there's going to be, you know, a support of Trump for that. And, of course, Trump could get behind Adams and it could go a different way. Mamdani, by the way, has been talking about this, despite the fact that Cuomo and Trump have said they're not in cohorts. Mamdani has been saying that is happening, and he's choosing to make it a target. I want to play a quick soundbite for you. Cut 12. Listen to this, Pierre.
New Yorkers do not want a mayor who is working in tandem with the president to subvert the will of the people of this city. We are talking about a president who has not just had that conversation with Andrew Cuomo, but one who is being briefed regularly with polling of this race and who is asking congresspeople as to what they think would be the best way to defeat our campaign. All of it comes back from the understanding that for Donald Trump, the victory that we would deliver for working-class New Yorkers is one that threatens the very basis of so much of his politics. It is a politics of insincerity.
Hey, what do you think about that?
You know, I don't see where Trump has really been against the working class of this country.
Right.
If anything, trying to create, you know, bring in domestic production into our country to help create jobs, especially for the working class people, auto manufacturing jobs, all the revenue coming in from tariffs. It's propaganda that you repeat enough and you truly believe this nonsense. You know, there's nothing here that Trump is doing that hurts the little person whatsoever. And they keep riding on the false promise of creating these policies that are just going to solve everything and create equality. It's never going to happen. You know, I hope Trump steps up and he backs one of the candidates. And I do hope, you know, this is a fight against communism, in my opinion. You know, I do hope that the government intervenes to some extent to help stop this. This is a complete catastrophe.
And you're so right. The Republican Party under Donald Trump has turned into the party of the working class. And that's not Griff Jenkins or Pierre DeVos saying it. It's literally the November election results showed that across literally every class, every age group, black, brown, white, young, old, you name it, you saw working class Americans cross the aisle and move in the direction of Trump. It's fascinating, Pierre. It's great to get your insight. You understand this. You live here. You understand the stakes. And as we watch this unfold, it's really going to be an interesting thing to see. And whether or not anyone can stop Mamdani, as we sit here today, we'll say, go on record and say, it's hard to see a way where it stopped, but a lot can happen between now and then. Pierre DeVos, great insight as always. Thanks for taking time and being a friend of the Brian Kilmeade Show. Have a great weekend.
Thank you too. Great seeing you.
All right. Pierre DeVos on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Wow. Mamdani, mayor, socialist New York City. It'll be something to watch and see if that actually happens. Meanwhile, I've got a few more thoughts about all things in the world. Griff Jenkins, your humble DC correspondent, filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the great Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be back.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And this is information you need to know. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show. And we have a Fox News Radio alert. There is a toxic boss alert. A member of Congress being labeled now as a toxic boss. Let me play you a little bit of her. You may recognize this voice. Listen.
We need to have some real guardrails around this Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has paved the way for half the stuff that we see that's going on. Listen, Donald Trump is a piece of shit. Okay, we know that. Yes, he is.
Ah, that is Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, Democrat of Texas. And we have had no shortage of those crazy rantings. But today we're getting in a New York Post headline, fascinating stories. The New York Post headline says Trump critic Rep. Jasmine Crockett is a no-show boss from hell who terrorizes staffers, aides, describing her as, quote, all diva, no wow. Some of the quotes from her actual former staffers is really unbelievable. One person says she is lying around her apartment, won't come into the office, and is really just indifferent to staff and will scream at them. She is never in the office and is very disengaged. She does her BS that goes viral and then freaks out
over the most random things. We also learn that she likes to be driven around, not by a member of staff in their car, which is what happens in most cases when members of Congress, the staffers, drive them around in either the member's car or in even the staffer's own car. She wants a rented Cadillac Escalade, and she is, quote, focused, one staffer says she's focused almost exclusively on being an influencer instead of being a member of Congress, and that she is treating these staffers as a Uber driver. It's a fascinating thing. And by the way, this story also covered by Fox Digital. Fox Digital reached out, in fairness, to Jasmine Crockett for a statement and did not get a response to let her refute or address or comment on these allegations of her being a diva. But it takes me back to the days when I was on the campaign trail. I was covering then presidential primary candidate Senator Amy Klobuchar, and we had learned as I was on the campaign trail covering her literally in New Hampshire that she was a toxic boss. The staff even said she was eating salads with combs. And I had to ask about that. I don't remember what she said. I just remember it was crazy. And now this of Jasmine Crockett. So much to cover on Friday. It is great to be here. Griff Jenkins in for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.